Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction. My name is Scott Weinberg, and I'm a film nerd, and I am joined by my friend, Dr. Science Nerd, Dr. Steven DeGennaro.
Hello.
Steven, we're going to Mars this episode. How do you feel about that?
I don't know. It might be a welcome respite from the heat.
let me ask you this, just as a scientist, if you could magically appear on any planet and not risk any adverse effects, what planet would you choose?
Venus.
Why so?
I don't know. I think it would be cool as hell. I mean, well, it would be the opposite of being cool as hell. But Venus is completely shrouded in poisonous clouds. We don't really have a very good idea of what the surface looks like. We've done some like radar measurements to try to look through the clouds, and we have had one lander land and almost instantly die by design. But so we don't really have a particularly great, you know, it would just be a hellscape, basically. Whereas I feel like Mars would probably just be boring, you know?
Boring. I was hoping you weren't going to say Mars, because Mars is a boring red rock, right? I mean, basically, as far as science goes, it's not that fascinating.
Well, I mean, if you were like a geologist, you know, or a planetologist of some sort, I bet there are lots of very fascinating things about it. But
planetologist is not a word.
No, but I mean, like, you know, well, your choices really are the inner planets, right? Because there isn't really a surface of Jupiter or Saturn or Neptune or Uranus. You could probably stand on Pluto. Pluto would be pretty cool.
Right. Like, do a lot of people know that? Like, do people even grasp that some planets don't literally have, like, a surface to land on?
Well, they do and they don't. So, you know, obviously Jupiter's a giant ball of gas, but and I haven't kept up with the...
Your face is a giant ball of gas.
I haven't kept up with all of the latest research, but from what I recall, there is a solid core somewhere down in there in all of those gas giant planets. We don't really have a whole lot of an idea of what it is like. You could theoretically stand on the surface. It just wouldn't be the surface that you see when you look at Jupiter. It would be the surface of the sort of rocky core of the planet, and you'd be inside the swirling clouds, which that could be kind of cool too, but I bet visibility there would probably be extremely minimal. So
let us start as most podcasts start in 1918. That was the first documented film that I could find, a 1918 film called A Trip to Mars. 1924, Alita, Queen of Mars. 1950, Rocket Ship XM. 1951, Flight to Mars. 1955, Conquest of Space. 1958, It, The Terror from Beyond Space, which most people will know was the inspiration for the Amazing Alien. 1959, The Angry Red Planet, which is a great title. Is it not, Steven?
Yeah.
1964, Santa Claus Conquers the Martian.
We got to cover that at some point, I think.
Also 1964, Steven loves this one, Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
I mean, I've never seen the movie, but it's just like that. The title is just the pitch. They're like, all right, what if we did Robin Crusoe, but on Mars? What do you want to call it? Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
Right. All right. And then in 1965, The Wizard of Mars. 1968, Mission Mars. 1977, Capricorn 1. 1986, Star Crystal. 1990, Total Recall. 1997, Rocket Man. And that brings us to 2000. And sci-fi filmmaker extraordinaire Brian De Palma, who had made so many brilliant science fiction films at this point in his career, Brian De Palma, who, I'm being sarcastic, never directed science fiction after or before, fresh off of Mission Impossible 1, and this is what he chose. He probably thought it was going to be 2001 mixed with a mild adventure movie, but it's based on a Disney ride. And man, this is not a good film. No. Steven, what do you think about Mission to Mars?
So I watched this probably about a week ago. I remember almost nothing about it. I think maybe Gary Sinise is in it.
Right, but that information does not lend itself well to a good podcast.
Yes. Well, so, but then I looked back at my notes right before we started recording, And there's a whole lot of cursing in my notes. So it certainly impacted me at the time.
What? All right. No, here, let's start this way. Because, you know, you and I, we like to be A, honest, and B, positive. I mean, like, we're movie and science nerds. We like this stuff. But this is a bad movie. And I think it's bad because the screenplay is just an amorphous mess.
Yeah, it's
the visual side. It looks pretty. A lot of the effects in this movie look pretty. A lot of the cast is solid. The Ennio Morricone score is quite lovely. But the screenplay is consistently, constantly exposition heavy, clunky, dour, dull, dreary. Lots of D words.
Yeah.
Steven, cut me off.
No, it's absolutely. I mean, like I will point out one example that is symptomatic, I think, of the whole. There is a whole opening sequence, which, you know, De Palma does in a very typical sort of show-offy single take of people, you know, the astronauts that are about to leave for Mars at a, you know, some sort of barbecue, you know, the day or whatever before they leave. There's a whole lot of exposition about how Gary Sinise is not going to get to go because his wife died, and so he got scrubbed from the mission, but she was supposed to be a scientist. And it's just characters telling one another stuff they all already know in order to catch the audience up.
I love it. It's like me and you getting together for a barbecue and talking about in full proper nouns everything we've ever worked on together.
Yeah, exactly. Remember that time when you flew that airplane through the through the heart of the storm? It's just, oh, it's so bad. But making it even more egregious is the fact that they then immediately repeat all of that information in the following scene, like as they're getting ready to I can't even remember exactly what the scene was, but I think it's they're getting ready to go to Mars, or they've already left for Mars and Gary Sinise is still stuck back home.
Oh yeah, no, there.
No, some plot machinations happens. Look, again, I remember nothing about what happened in this movie. Somehow or another, Gary Sinise ends up going on the mission. And in order for that all to happen, they have to have like literally the exact same conversations over again, telling you about Gary Sinise and about how his wife died and how they were supposed to go on the mission. Like it's the identical information. It's like you did not need that opening scene in any way whatsoever. But it is emblematic of the movie that has so little story that the structure is just so weird. You get this opening scene. Oh no, that's what it is. Because then you have the first mission, which is Don Cheadle and some other people who I couldn't even name.
Yeah, no, Don is literally the only person who matters in this.
And something goes wrong. They find this pyramid thing that turns out to be a face, and these people get sucked up into this very unconvincing CGI vortex. The science of which we'll get into in a second. And then we cut to sort of what's the real story, which again is another sort of thing that I didn't know who the protagonist of this story was pretty much the entire movie. I got sort of by the end that maybe it was supposed to be Gary Sinise, but like
I think for a while there it's Connie Nielsen in the middle. It's just
so weird. It just keeps switching POVs and
Tim Robbins for a while. Yep.
Yeah, and it's just like it feels very much like an and then, you know, which you know, in contrast to the other movie we're going to talk about, which is, you know, just a so but from beginning to end. So this thing happens. So he tries this, but this happens. So he tries something else, but that, and like that chain of consequences, which is what a good story is made of.
Right. And in a movie, we've already talked about this, in a movie like Sunshine, if it's written really well, that chain of events and then could be a lot of fun.
No, I'm saying, but that's not a chain of events. Those are things that, you know, there's a consequence and then an action taken, and then a consequence to that action and then another action taken to try to fix that. In Mission to Mars, it's just a series of things that just kind of happen. There's a little bit in that middle section, I guess, where like somebody, again, I remember so little about this movie. I just said a week ago. What's his name? Tim Robbins dies in a long, drawn out, like 45-minute long scene where, they're going to save him. No, they can't save him. Oh, they're going to save him. No. Oh, they're going to save him. No, he's going to kill himself. It's just, it goes on forever.
It really feels to me, because, you know, I couldn't care less about the veracity of the science to a movie. But as far as dramatics go, there's nothing here. There was an emergency. Something bad happened on our Mars mission. And now here's another crew going to find out what happened. And then once we get there, after losing one of our crew members, It turns out to be a whole bunch of new age spacey mumbo jumbo nonsense that makes Contact look like Event Horizon.
Sort of, yes and no. I mean, clearly that is the idea. And really, really, truly, this movie feels like a theme park ride. It feels, it has that sort of episodic, you know, structure that like Disney rides, you know, typically have, where like you go in the first, you know, because they want you, you have to wait in line for 2.5 hours. And so they want you occupied while you're doing that instead of just standing in line. So they have you enter like a foyer and one thing happens and, oh, we're prepping for the mission. And, oh, you hear about how the last mission went down and the transmission and blah, blah, blah. And then you move into another room and then like another sort of piece of the story gets told. And then you move in for the main event. And really that feels like that's how this movie is structured, where like you just have these little things that happen as precursors to this. Oh, okay. Well, here's the big idea. The big idea is, spoiler alert, turns out aliens built this face on Mars so that when humans were space capable, I guess they could find it and get in this ship and travel to this distant galaxy.
Yeah. Is that the biggest hook that screenwriters can come up with? Is, hey, we're on a distant planet. It turns out Earthlings came from here.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
No.
Earthlings came from the moon or Mars or Jupiter. Earthlings came from a meteor. That's not that interesting at this point. Even in 2000, when this movie came out, that's not that interesting.
No. And it treats it with so much seriousness. You watch, you know, it's a movie that, like you said, is really trying to be like Contact or 2001, where you're like doing this, you know, profound, you know, using science fiction to try to tell this profound story about the origins of humanity and where we're going and where we're coming from. And it's
the philosophical contemplations on the nature of man. And yeah,
you know. But it's the Disney ride version of that, you know?
Yes. Yeah, but you nailed it. Like the movie does have ebbs and flows like little theme park rides, but those theme park rides, they have engineers, imagineers whose job it is to make every inch of those rides fun.
Yeah. And
this,
they're interesting.
In between, like, there's a couple of eye popping moments in this movie, some really beautiful visual effects, but there's no sense of real awe or excitement or danger.
For all of the talent involved in this movie and on the acting side, and obviously De Palma as a director, it feels like those skits that they do while you're waiting in line at Disney World. Like the level of the acting, the level of the character.
What if there was an earthquake on the surface of Mars and we all go, whoa.
And the floor starts shaking a little. Yeah, like
Jerry O'Connell shakes and holds on to something.
It does. It feels like that and nothing more than that. And it's just bizarre.
Off the top of my head, I think this was the first theatrical film made from the Disney rides. There was a 1997 TV movie called Tower of Terror, but that's a TV movie. And so I think before Country Bears, before Pirates, before Haunted Mansion, it was this. This was the flagship or the test.
Which makes sense.
And it made money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's of those properties, this is the one that you would think, okay, well, this is the most readily adaptable to a cinematic sort of.
I just can't see how you're not in, and this might be why there are like four credited writers plus David Goyer and Ted Talley are both credited as producers, and they're both very prolific, good screenwriters. So this movie was clearly, you know, written and rewritten 800 times, but watching it, there's just very little sense of fun or adventure. It just seems very dry and stoic.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it has to do with too many screenwriting cooks in the kitchen. And De Palma, whom I like very much as a guy who wants to dip his toe into every single genre at least once, clearly that's one of his goals.
Yeah.
I just don't think the guy has the touch or the wonderment or the sensibility for sci-fi.
Not his forte, at least if this is any indication.
Like, he's really good at crime and the underbelly and sleazy people doing things.
And horror.
And horror. He's very good at thrillers and intensity and suspense. This movie needs a sense of kind of a little bit of Raiders and a little bit of maybe even, God forbid, Star Wars. Something a little gee whiz.
It's way too silly to take seriously.
Yeah.
But it's way too serious to be enjoyable as fun, the way that like Stargate or The Fifth Element are.
The main question I wanted to ask you is, which do you think the film flails bigger at, the entertainment value or the science value?
Well, so that's a good transition. Let's get into the science here.
Because I am good at transition, sir.
It's a tough call. I would say it fails much harder at the science. As much as we are ragging on the entertainment value of the movie for the last 15 minutes, the science.
Which was the biggest head slaps for you? The movie, I'm going to start calling these head slaps, where you're watching it and somebody says, oxygen doesn't, you know, put the oxygen, and you slap your head in Texas going, that's not how oxygen works at all.
All right. In contrast to, again, the movie we will be discussing in the second half, this movie, one of my biggest pet peeves, and I'll talk about this a bit more when we get there, is just how wrong movies get scientists and science and astronauts. It's not even necessarily a specific sort of thing of like, oh, well, that couldn't happen to a mountain that blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm talking about just like, this is not the way scientists are as people. This is not, especially not the way that astronauts are as people. This is not the way things are decided. So a couple of things jump out at me in that regard. One of them is there's a scene where Gary Sinise.
I thought you were going to say one of them is Jerry O'Connell. And that was going to be the whole point.
One of those two. One of them is the fact that Jerry O'Connell and Gary Sinise appear to be wearing eyeliner and lipstick throughout the whole movie. Did you notice that? Is that just me? Was I?
I did not notice.
Gary Sinise is most definitely wearing eyeliner in a number of scenes, and it's really weird and disconcerting. They, you know, there's this whole scene where they have to send the rescue mission, and I keep wanting to say Ed Harris because in my brain it's Ed Harris, but it's not. It's Tim Robbins.
Tim Robbins is
like,
taller.
Yeah, Tim Robbins is like, we have to bring Gary Sinise, and the guy who's in charge of NASA or in charge of the missions, I don't even know who he is, which is kind of part of my point. He's like, oh, I'm not going to send Gary Sinise. He hasn't trained properly. I had to ground him because his wife died, which is that scene that I was talking about where like he goes through the entire chain of, you know, how he ended up not on the mission. Gary Sinise, I guess, tries to convince him and finally convinces him. And the idea that this is just one guy's decision, that like this guy, we never see anybody else. We never see any, I mean, again, in contrast to The Martian, where like every single decision is a decision, a group decision among a whole bunch of different experts about, well, what are the pros? What are the cons? What are our options? You know, and a big, you know, communal experience.
Okay. So what you're saying, Stephen, is that for me to choose a navigator on a Mars mission is not the same as me being like, Stephen, can I be on your softball team?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, all right, fine. I'll allow it. It's like, no. That is not how any of that works. All right. There's like there's layers and layers of bureaucracy and you know, full analysis of what the risks and costs and benefits could be. And like, no decision is made on an individual person's whim.
Do you think, obviously, a lot of filmmakers consult technical advisors, but do you think many filmmakers say, hey, if you and seven colleagues were on in a space station for 6 months, what would your general demeanor, what would the morale be like? What would your behavior be towards each other? Do they even care?
I think this is my big soapbox here about astronaut movies in general. It's one of the reasons why I love The Martian, one of the reasons why I love Apollo 13. Movies that get astronauts right and still are able to create a tense, scary thing. I think a lot of filmmakers rely on this idea of like, okay, well, you need to show that your actors are completely freaked out or your audience won't be completely freaked out. And so, this is especially true in sci-fi horror, but it's true here as well, where like astronauts are chosen specifically because they are the coolest freaking people under pressure that you can possibly imagine.
Well, it's like fighter pilots. You never see an Air Force fighter pilot veteran who's like a nervous wreck or
afraid of anything. Yeah.
Or a jittery or loud, caffeinated nut. Yeah. They're always very laconic, chill, laid back, quiet, you know, like,
and they might get angry at times or whatever, but like, but no, this idea of like running around in this sort of afraid, there's this amazing story, and maybe I'll find a link that we can put up on the Twitter, but this astronaut telling the story about how his cooling system broke on his suit and they couldn't get the airlock door closed. And so he was literally going to boil alive inside his suit, which is what will happen if you can't, if the cooling system is not working. Like your body heat just, you know, it's like being under 1,000 blankets. There's no place for your body heat to go in space because it doesn't, you know, there's no air. And so your body heat you just get hotter and hotter and hotter unless you have some sort of cooling system. His cooling system broke and they're trapped in this airlock and they can't get the door to close. And they kind of are going through this checklist of like, okay, well, what are the things that we can do? What are the possibilities? And the way he tells the story, like, you know, he admits that he was terrified, but at the same time, like, he's like, my training kicked in and we just went through the checklist of different things that we could try. And I, you know, I kind of came to grips with the fact that I was going to die and, you know, in the most horrific way possible. And, that was just what was going to happen. And you know, it's just like the way he tells the story is just, it's just fascinating to, cause that's so not me.
You could see an astronaut or a technical advisor telling this to like people like Gary Sinise and Tim Robbins, and then them walking away thinking, yeah, but I'm an actor. People don't want to see me just being quiet and chill. They want to see me cry a little and scream and rail against the dying of the, you know, like they don't want to, like, they don't want to be just.
Maybe, you know. Maybe not. I mean, there are, you know, again, we're going to talk about this. Maybe we should do the other one first, but, you know, in The Martian, there's a massive roster of incredibly talented actors who do exactly what they need to in the moment to get across everything that they need without ever over emoting or, you know, being actors.
Dude, there's so many things in The Martian that feels like somebody decided, I finally want to write the movie that rights all these stupid wrongs. And now you can use this movie as your your scientific template moving forward. But anyway, let's save that for a second. But yeah, back to what we were talking about with science. What do you are the three biggest head slappers in this movie on a scientific level?
Okay, so there's a scene in which Jerry O'Connell is floating around in zero gravity with a bunch of M&Ms, which, side note for a second, the product placement in this movie, this is Dr. Pepper shot. There's so much product placement in this movie. It's ridiculous. Yep. Which doesn't surprise me, I guess, for a movie based on a Disney ride. But
the older a movie gets, the more the product placement sticks out.
Yeah.
I was just flipping channels and I saw the first 15 or 20 minutes of The Island, the Michael Bay one. And Xbox is everywhere on that movie. All right, sorry, go ahead.
So anyway, so he's building this little, a little double helix thing out of M&Ms, which first of all, probably would not be possible in zero gravity. Like there's nothing, like if you touch something in zero gravity, there's not really anything to slow it down. And so like the ability to take a thing and stick it at an exact point in space and then let it go and have it stay in that exact place.
The precision is,
this is not really a thing you can do. It's hard to do with a single thing. You definitely couldn't do it. Like, it would take him hours of trial and error, and then, you know, one errant, you know, breath could blow them all, you know. So, you know, the physics of that is dubious to begin with. But then I think it's Gary Sinise, or it might have been Tim Robbins, asked him what this is his DNA strand of. And he says, my perfect woman. And then Gary Sinise pulls one of the M&Ms out and eats it. And he goes, well, what is it now? And he's like, oh, I think it's a frog. And it's meant obviously to be played as a joke, but at the same time, it has just enough sort of seriousness to it that when they call it back again later on, because then, you know, towards the end of the movie, they are analyzing the DNA of this creature, or they're analyzing the DNA that open the door. Again, I don't even remember.
I think I know why you have a problem with this. Tell me if this is why. If it was just a one-off joke, you'd be like, well, that's not how DNA works, but who cares? Yeah. It's a joke.
Right.
But the fact that it's like a Chekhov's gun plot point makes it extra dumb.
It gets especially egregious when they look at this picture and it is literally like maybe 15, 20 base pairs of one section of a helical coil of DNA. And Gary Sinise looks at it and he goes like, that's human DNA. And it's like, what? No. That would be like looking at like one molecule on the bumper of a car and going, oh, that's a 1952 Studebaker. It's just, right. It's not like, you can't do that. That's not, you know, and then they confuse the number of DNA strands with the number of DNA base pairs. It's just, and it's almost entirely unnecessary either. Like, I don't know. The science of it is just makes my head hurt.
It gets to the point of our show, though, doesn't it? Because it wouldn't have cost anything but an extra 15 minutes to get that stuff right. So why not? Why not get it right? It's not that.
Well, so, but this is the frustrating thing about it, right? Like, I understand, like, if you're watching something and you don't understand something about how the way, you know, orbital mechanics works, you don't understand anything about, you know, rocketry, whatever. This is literally ninth grade science. Like, I'm not a biologist. The last time I knew anything about biology or had anything to do with biology was when I was a freshman in high school. And even I know that that's not how DNA works. It's one of those things where, like, how is there nobody at any point in this process that was like, no, that's not even close enough most of your audience is going to recognize that that's not how that works.
Well, no, they're not.
Maybe, I don't know. Anybody that's, again, anybody that's taken ninth grade biology, or at least anybody that remembers their ninth grade biology, there's a place where, oh God, there's a shot of Mars as they're approaching, and they see a dust storm, and you can see the clouds moving. Like they're in space. They're looking down at the planet. And they see the dust clouds. They can actually see the dust clouds progressing over the surface of the planet.
As if you're on the surface looking up at a rain cloud.
Well, have you ever seen a picture or a video of a hurricane on Earth?
Yes, I have.
Like you have to sit there and watch it for like an hour to notice that it's actually swirling around, because even at 150 miles an hour, those winds are not, you know, the Earth is so huge.
Yes, but Stephen, my local weather woman, meteorologist, I should say, will speed it up. Using technology, the Doppler, so I can see it moving.
Right, but they aren't. This is not what's happening. They're literally looking down at the surface of the planet. It's not a movie. It's not a picture. They're looking out a window at the surface of the planet, and those clouds would be moving at tens of thousands of miles per hour in order to be able to actually see them moving across the surface of the planet.
Okay, no. All right, now that one bugs you. Do you think that when the general audience member sees that, you know, they're looking down at a planet and you'd never see clouds moving in that pattern, does a general audience member know or care? Or does it just like,
wouldn't want to presume. I mean, you're the general audience member. You tell me.
No, that did not stick out to me as something impossible. Let's say that.
Okay.
If you had said, look, does that look like something you've seen before? I'd say no, but is it impossible? No, I don't know. I'm not an astronaut.
But it gets wrong the scale of how big planets are, which is a thing I guess a lot of people have a really hard time wrapping their heads around. I mean, this is the reasons why we have flat earthers, is because people don't appreciate just how big the Earth is.
Why do you think filmmakers will choose to go with the dumber? Is it just because, hey, well, the dumber one gives us a cool visual and the smart one doesn't?
Yeah. I mean, I think in that case, I think in both of these cases with the DNA thing and with the swirling, it was like, oh, okay, well, I think of this cool visual of him making these DNA strands out of M&Ms. And then we can call back to that later on. And with the dust storms, they did get one thing right about the dust storms, which is they talked about how dust storms can cover the whole planet and last for a year. They can actually last for several Martian years, and they can absolutely cover the entire planet.
Martian years, like Mars has its own year. Come on. What is 1 year? What is one Earth year equal in Mars?
I do not know that off the top of my head. It's a couple, I think it's like 2.5 years. I should probably look it up. It is 687 days. So yeah, it's about double. A little bit less than 2 years.
Neat.
The Martian day, in contrast, which I think they mentioned actually in The Martian, is actually about 23-ish minutes longer than the Earth day. So it's 24 hours and change. And so there's been a lot of stuff in both science fiction and in sort of speculative, like, okay, if we actually ever go to Mars, how will we keep time? Because it's almost 24 hours, but just a little bit longer than – it's 37 minutes longer than 24 hours. So how would we run our clocks? Would we space out 24 hours so that it lasted 24 hours and 37 minutes?
I know how we do it. We just make sure that everybody sleeps an extra 34 minutes. Every
yeah, but
day.
Like, what does your clock say during those 34 minutes?
Who cares? You're sleeping. all right, Stephen, do you have any final science compliments or comments on this movie?
Yeah. So they encounter Don Cheadle, and Don Cheadle at first thinks that they're hallucinations or ghosts because he's gone crazy. He's got space madness, I guess.
Dementia. From Steve Space Buscemi. Dementia.
Space dementia. So his first instinct is, of course, you know, hey, I'm hallucinating, so I'm going to hit this hallucination with an axe. Because that, get rid of hallucinations. He's not really established as being crazy. Like, he's not like, he thinks that he's misapprehending reality, but he's not actually misapprehending reality. So, like, why
would he attack
his first instinct be to attack this hallucination? And then somebody says long-term exposure to low gravity can have an effect on the brain, and that's what causing him to go mad. And no, that isn't how that works at all. There are people – he's only been there for like a year at that point.
Excuse me, Stephen, if gravity is working harder on your brain, then it's going to make you dumber. Everybody knows that.
Gravity is working less hard on your brain if you're on Mars.
Well,
Mars has lower
then
gravity.
It's bouncing onto the top of your skull?
It must be, I guess. So then they have to decide whether or not they're going to leave. And somebody says, oh, if we leave here without figuring out what it is, they will all have died in vain. And I'm just like, dude, That face pyramid thing has been there for literally millions of years. It will still be right there if you go home and send back a probe or send a second mission out. Like we will eventually know what that. I can guarantee you.
Right.
They will figure out what the heck
right.
that
if,
face
if
is.
We don't, if we don't walk into it right now, the discovery means nothing.
Yeah, it's like, no, that is, yeah.
It really just feels, and I hate to keep banging the same drum, it feels like they wanted to make sure they had enough audio-visual neatness to put in a trailer.
Last little bits of science, and here's where I cursed in my notes. So, number one, they decide all three of them are going to go into this mysterious space pyramid thing, which, again, not a thing scientists would do. Not a thing explorers would do, not a thing astronauts would do. Like, you don't all three of you go into the potentially dangerous situation. You send one person into the potentially dangerous situation and make sure it's not actually dangerous before you go send everybody into the dangerous situation. And so then they go in and they do that thing that they do in so many freaking astronaut movies that just grinds my gears. Where they look at a little tiny readout on their little wrist thing or whatever, and they go, oh, it's, we show oxygen and nitrogen. Let's all take off our helmets at the same time. Let's not even wait. So Gary Sinise takes off his helmet because he's, like, convinced that he can breathe there. The other two don't even wait to see if, like, you know, he dies 12 seconds later.
What?
And they're just like, all right, if he's taking off his helmet, I guess we have to take off our helmets, too.
That's my question, Stephen. Just if you had a computer that could tell you, hey, oxygen exists here. So in theory, we could breathe. That doesn't mean there aren't other poisons. That doesn't mean there aren't, like, that doesn't mean it's entirely
biological
safe.
Agents. Doesn't mean that there's not, right. It doesn't mean that there's not, like, trace element, you know, like arsenic
right.
floating around in the air or, like, yeah, yeah, no.
But that's, you know, we all know why that is. It's because movie stars got to show their face. That's all.
Well, yeah, it's the same with the lights in the helmet.
Right.
But at the very minimum, again, there's no reason not to do, like, let the one guy take off his helmet and actually, like, breathe in the air and go, like, okay, I'm not dead. All right, now it's probably safe for the other two to take their helmets off. But, like, it frustrates me. I did think it was a nice little touch. I don't know whether they do this or not. I mean, they don't, I would imagine, because it doesn't usually come in handy. But, each of the astronauts had different color sort of trim, like different colored stripes on their spacesuits. Like one of them was orange, one of them was blue, one of them was green, I think. So that you could just look at you could look at the spacesuit and you could see, okay, that's Gary Sinise. That's Connie Nielsen.
It kind of sums up a lot of the movie, though. The characters are identifiable by color, but not by personality.
So that's a thing. I think, you know, it is not a thing that we do probably now, because, like, if you go on a spacewalk, it's at most two people. So if you see somebody and it's not you, then it's the other person. But if you had, you know, a mission of five or six people walking around on a planet, it would be good to be able to, like, look at a glance and see, okay, that's Fred, that's Bob, that's Jane. So if Jane starts screaming, you can run towards Jane and not have to go, okay, well, which one of the three people am I hearing in my little communicator in my ear?
All right. So you know what? Mission to Mars. Thumbs up for your color-coded spacesuit.
But then it throws it all away. It throws it all away, that tiny little bit of goodwill that it built up. The two people who survived, which again, I think, is it Don Cheadle and Connie Nielsen? I can't even remember.
They all survived. Everybody from here after Tim Robbins died.
Okay, so but there are three people in this final scene.
Yeah, because Sinise wants to go off Close Encounter style.
Right. So, but Gary Sinise, whatever. The other two leave. Gary Sinise decides to stay by and go into the thing. The rocket ship launches, and it shows him traveling towards a spiral galaxy. Now, longtime listeners of the show may recall me having talked about this in the past, but the distances to the nearest star are, no pun intended, astronomical. To get to the closest stars would take you years at the speed of light. The nearest spiral galaxy, which is the Andromeda Galaxy, is 2.2 million light years away. And that thing was not some sort of, like, super advanced spaceship. It looked like just a rocket. And so you're supposed to believe that somehow he gets on this rocket and is flying towards a spiral galaxy, which, by the way, was not the Andromeda Galaxy, because it doesn't look like the Andromeda Galaxy, but some spiral galaxy that's at least 2.2 million light years away at the speed of any sort of chemical rocket would take literally hundreds of millions of years to reach. So Gary Sinise is going to die 0.00000001% of the way through that journey.
That should make for a fun sequel.
It's just Gary Sinise going, oh, crap.
Oh, no, I'm going to die in this ship.
I forgot to bring food and water.
What did I think? What was I thinking?
I'm going to be dead in
a week. I could have just gone back to Earth and had the cheeseburger. All right, so. I think that, I mean, this might be one of the worst films that we've covered, and it sucks because there are, obviously, between De Palma and Morricone and a lot of the cast, there a lot of talented people worked on this, and if you are a hardcore sci-fi nut, it obviously is a, you know, a major Hollywood release. You're going to check off your list eventually. But as far as sci-fi nuts are concerned, I think we would both put this way, way down on your list. On an entertainment value, I give this movie 2.5 out of 5 stars. Yeah, 2.
What grade is that? What grade would that be?
That would be like a D. Yeah. and that's literally for the effects and the music. For science, I'm giving it an F because it literally is just... I, to my layman's eyes and ears, it has a real just lack of effort. And it's just when you could, we had the internet in 2000, you could have just Googled how much, or I'm sorry, ask Jeeves how much distance is between two stars and put 12 in your script instead of 8. You could have done that.
Yeah.
And you didn't. So, you know, bad movie. Sorry to say.
Yeah, I mean, I agree on both of those grades. As an entertainment, it gets a D. As a science, maybe an F plus. because of the because it at least recognizes that like Mars exists and you know I didn't even get into this, but the surface that they decided for Mars was completely wrong too. It looked like they bought a bunch of like of those little red rocks that you buy to like put around your pool area.
Oh yeah,
for like landscaping rocks that are all the exact same size.
Right, and one of them has a little fake door in the bottom that has your house key in it.
Yeah, exactly.
I did want to mention also in the same year as Mission to Mars, this was extra credit. Stephen, have you happened to see a film called Red Planet?
So we went back and forth on which of those movies to pair with The Martian, and I kind of wish we had done that one instead because I can't imagine it's worse. But then again, I didn't find this movie as bad as you do in terms of like this movie doesn't make me angry kind of bad. I just feel it's just not good. Whereas I get the sense that Red Planet would make me like mad.
Red Planet is kind of like this, except when the astronauts land on Mars. The robot that they brought with them goes crazy and starts killing them.
Maybe that would be better.
That's literally the plot. And it is more fun. It's also a very stupid movie, but it is at least seems to be aware that it's a B movie.
Well, we should do that against like Ghosts of Mars at some point.
Ooh, all right. All right. So that means we are now moving on to a much better film. One of those few films that I used to do this a lot when I was younger. Stephen, do you do this when you're really excited for a movie? Will you read the novel first?
I will generally not. I will avoid doing that unless I feel like there's enough time. Because if I read the book, within a couple months even of seeing the movie, I will just be, without intending to, I will just be sitting there comparing it to the book in my head the whole time.
Right.
Oh, that thing's different. Oh, especially the fresher the book is, the harder it is to just be like, all right, I'm just going to watch the movie and let the movie be the movie. So if I haven't read the book, I won't.
When I was younger, I would very often read a fun novel before the movie came out. Nowadays, it's the opposite. If I really like a movie and people tell me the book is good, I'll read it after, because now it almost feels like the book is almost the screenwriter's special bonus edition, you know?
Exactly.
So this I read beforehand. And of course, as I'm reading it, I plugged in every character actor from the movie in my brain. I plugged them into the book. I really like the book. I absolutely love The Martian. And I think what I love the most about it is that, I mean, it has so much interesting science, but at its base, it's just literally a story about like not giving up. He could be trapped under the ocean. He could be trapped in the Mojave Desert. And, you know, him coming to terms with his limitations, his intellect, his will to live. The setting is almost secondary, but then you add it being Mars and not the Mojave Desert or the bottom of the ocean. And that just makes the sci-fi hook so much more interesting. And I love this movie, and it's much more interesting to me to hear what a scientist thinks of this movie. So go ahead.
I mean, you know, this movie gets everything right on both the science and the artistic level, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, the science in particular, right? And to me, it's again, it's up there with like Apollo 13, I almost said Apollo 18. It's up there with Apollo.
It's not that.
We have to do that pairing at some point.
Yep.
You know, it's up there with Apollo 13, you know, which obviously is a true story. And it shows that you do not need all of these affectations. You do not need to, like, goose the science or goose, you know, like, oh, well, we need to make it even more dire. We need to do this in a way. We need to compress all these characters together so that there's only one person in charge of NASA instead of the 15 people that each have different jobs. Like, this movie balances all of that stuff so perfectly.
That's a good point. And I really think by having a great ensemble when you're away from Matt Damon on Mars makes the film infinitely more interesting. If it was just half the movie is Matt Damon on Mars and half the movie is three people in a boardroom, that's not
cool. It reminds me a lot of Contagion in that regard.
Yeah.
Where it's like, we're going to take the science, we're going to treat it seriously. We do not need to sort of turn this into the zombie apocalypse in order for it to be tense and scary and really good.
I also like that this is a movie that it covers bureaucracy, but it's not hateful or cynical. It shows you, sometimes an organization is swamped in bureaucracy and everything has to be stamped by 12 different people. But in some cases, that's really important. It's not necessarily
awful
that bureaucracy exists.
Right. And there's no villain in this movie. The villain is Mars. Nope. The villain is the situation.
Nope. There are some people who will butt heads with our well-meaning heroes. There are some government bodies and cynics, but there's never any just straight up villain.
Yeah, no. I mean, but you can contrast that with like Outbreak, you know, or some of these other movies that we've covered where like you have to have somebody who's like the officious, government bureaucrat person who's always wrong on everything and always making the bad decision. And
like the literal epitome of badness or malice. Yeah.
Like Jeff Daniels is the closest thing to sort of an obstruction. And even he is not like, you understand exactly why he's doing what he's doing. He's not played as a villain. He's not played as like the heavy. He has a one perspective and
as most scientists and anybody in a bureaucracy or in a body of government will tell you, it's somebody who says, oh, I have a great idea. And then those three people who say, yeah, that's a good idea, but those three people are important.
Yeah.
Those three people matter. Your good idea.
Well, in NASA in particular, yeah.
Yeah, your good idea is not always a perfect idea. And those three people who kind of butt heads with you might save lives.
Again, they get right that sort of that culture of NASA of like, okay, here's what I think the plan should be. What are the things that could go wrong with it? What are the odds that those things will happen? What are the upsides? What are the downsides? And then somebody like Jeff Daniels or whoever, you know, is in charge of that particular thing. Him and Sean Bean sort of butting head, where Sean Bean wanted to keep the astronauts in the loop a lot more because he was in charge of the astronauts specifically versus Jeff Daniels, who's in charge of NASA as a whole. And that dynamic, again, which never made either one of them the villain or the hero, that they both had sort of a difference of opinion and they both had pluses and minuses to their opinion. I don't know. It gets all of that cultural stuff so right.
What I like about this movie is, and you mentioned Apollo 13, I think it gets it really good, is the compartmentalization of NASA. Like that guy or that girl right there is just in charge of the fuel tank. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah.
You know, and like that stuff is, it's both, well, it can be really dull if you just, you know, list it all like that. But if you make them important at certain points in the movie, that's very dynamic.
Yeah.
You know, this woman who's just in charge of the fuel tank and that might not speak up for days. Now, all of a sudden, that department is key.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Well, they do some great stuff with that with Mackenzie Davis, you know, who has some moments where she appears to be in charge of the satellite that's looking down on the surface of Mars. You've got some great, great, great scenes with Donald Glover, which also I think really sort of nails that like somewhat cocky, you know, young, brash, super, super smart engineer person who's convinced that, you know,
they're right.
He's right. And he is right in the sense of like he's definitely right about the physics of how they might do that. But he also is not the kind of person who necessarily would consider, okay, well, what are all of the political implications? What are the PR implications? What are the mission implications? Like, how can this go wrong?
Yeah, that's what's so cool about this movie is that at its core, you say, oh, what is The Martian about? Oh, it's about an astronaut who is trapped alone on Mars with very limited resources, and he's rigging up every single mechanical device he has to buy himself another few hours until he can either get himself off the planet or get rescued. A, that's it. Right. That's what it's about. But like you said, it has all these little tendrils about the how Americans look at this kind of tragedy and how it impacts the international stage and the political era and the guilt that the people on the ground who, you know, that if they lose this guy, how terrible they'll feel. Even it's just yeah. it covers the whole spectrum of what would happen yeah. if somebody was trapped on Mars, not just one guy trapped. But let's get into what's most fun about this movie, I think, which is the unending cascade of bad things that go wrong for this astronaut. I mean, that is, you know, it's like it becomes a comedy of errors in a way.
It does, but again, it never feels over the top to me. It feels every single one of these things, and this is true because from the book, every single moment in this entire movie feels like when you read stories about astronauts, when you read stories about, okay, well, like, you know, the Hubble servicing mission where they went up to try to change the mirror on this Hubble servicing mission, you know, which itself was already a screw up because the Hubble telescope had the mirrors were miscalibrated. And so all the pictures were coming back fuzzy on this $1 billion satellite. And so they said, okay, well, is there any way we can fix it? What are some plans to fix it? They spend years planning on how to install this stuff to fix it. And then they get up there and they can't get the panel open. They have two people doing a spacewalk and they can't get the panel open. Like the tool that he brought, like didn't fit with something or other. And so they had to decide, are we going to scrub the whole mission? Is there some, I don't remember the details of how they ended up figuring out, but it's that same sort of thing. It's like, okay, well, how can we MacGyver a solution to this? What is available to the astronauts right now? Okay, well, they have paper clips, they have rubber bands, they have a carbon dioxide filter that's this shape and this size. Well, how can we like build something out of those things that we can then use as a tool to? And that, you know, this movie is filled with all those kinds of things. You see it a lot in again, I keep bringing it up, but Apollo 13, which is all 100% true. And you know, every single step of like, okay, well, things go wrong all the time in space. And again, it's one of the reasons why when they pick astronauts, they pick people who aren't going to, you know, immediately when something goes wrong, go, oh crap, we're all going to die. They do like Matt Damon did, which is like, all right, what's, and he says this, I think towards the end, which is what's the next problem that I have to solve? What's the most immediate and important problem that I have to solve? Okay, well, my suit is leaking. I need to, you know, get into the habitat. I'm bleeding. I need to stitch that up. And it's just solve one problem, solve another problem, solve another problem. And if you solve enough of them, eventually, hopefully, you get to go home. And I think that's to me is a lot of that's what astronaut training is, right? It's not just it's not just training for doing the thing that you're supposed to do. It's training for every single possible way that thing could go wrong, and what are you going to do? And then practicing, okay, well, if your suit starts leaking, here's the protocol, here's the things that you're supposed to do in this order. If you know, if you get hit by a micrometeorite, here are the things that you know you would do. And so just there's like, that is, to me, I don't know, I love this movie because it gets all of that stuff completely right, and it's tense, and from almost minute one, like, things start going wrong. There's no 20 minutes of like, well, let's get to know the characters and, you know, have this pre-launch thing.
Oh, yeah, here's a 15-minute flashback of him with his family.
Yeah.
And then we'll cut, you know, it really is tight. It's a long movie, but it maintains a lot of tension throughout. Because you like him, you like the people on the ground. And, you know, it really, you could see not just Andy Weir, the screenwriting by Drew Goddard, who I think adapts this book brilliantly, fantastically.
Yeah.
And you could see them wanting to strain realism as far as possible without people going, nah, that's a little, you know, you bend it, but don't break it. And, you know, a lot of sci-fi movies are like, we're cool with breaking it. But once in a while, it's one that says, you know what, let's do hard, speculative sci-fiction, but also keep it completely entrenched in realistic science.
Yes, and it is almost 100% realistic. There are a few minor sort of things. The sandstorm winds are considerably more forceful than any winds on Mars basically could be, because there's not, the atmosphere is so thin that the winds are not that forceful. There's just not enough mass in the atmosphere to really sort of drive that kind of forcefulness. It is a little weird. You know, what touches this whole thing off is that, they get this communication saying, oh, there's a sandstorm coming. You guys, we think you should probably launch. And when they open the door, the sandstorm is already there. I don't think, so hearkening back to what we were talking about earlier, if you see a sandstorm forming on this planet, you generally are going to have a while. Like, you're going to have some time before it gets there. And so it was a little weird that it was already upon them. It was a little weird that they would actually launch during the sandstorm, I would think. And I could be wrong about this. I haven't really read the book. I haven't studied the mission plans. But, like, I would imagine that staying hunkered down in the habitat might be a safer choice. But then again, if it destroyed your only way means of returning home, then that would be bad too. And like I said earlier, sandstorms on Mars can last like 2 years. So, like, you might end up having to wait forever and then die. So I guess, you know, that was the only thing that sort of jumped out at me. One of the only things that jumped out at me. I did not... okay, one thing in terms of astronaut culture, in terms of space shuttle launch culture, they did this three times, and it bothered me every single one of these times. They had three different launches that they watched. One of them, I think, was they were launching a supply rocket that was supposed to go to him, and then the second time they were launching the Chinese rocket, and then there's one at the end of the movie that's sort of in the epilogue. All three times, people start cheering while the engines are still running on the rocket. That's not a thing. Like, as long as the engines are running, everybody is sitting there doing their jobs going, okay, is everything going smooth? What's my little area? It's tense, right? You know, because anything can happen. You're still burning. You're basically on top of a controlled explosion, you know, and until you turn the explosion off, that's when everybody kind of breathes a sigh of relief. Like, okay, it's made it into orbit. The engines are off. Now is when you can go, okay, that launch was successful. And it happens in this movie. They start cheering and they're like, yay, the launch was successful. And then the rocket blows up. And that's exactly why at real launches, they don't cheer until the engines turn off. And did we hit our target? Is the thing going to end up in the orbit where we needed to end up in? And then... that's when now that was successful, that part of the mission. So that kind of bugged me a little bit.
But your take on Kristen Wiig as the NASA media chip boss, as a character, you really think early in the film, oh, she's going to be the ball buster. And
yep.
She's a good person too.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like, that, it would have been so easy for hacky screenwriters and directors to turn that character and the Jeff Daniels character into the sort of heavies, into the people who are like, oh, well, I care more about how this looks to the public than the safety of the astronauts. And neither one of those people ever loses sight of the safety of the astronauts, but they also have this other job that they have to worry about. And that's, you know, how is this going to play to people? How is it going to help our funding? How is it going to hurt what we're doing here? And, you know, that's a thing that is true. I did wonder a little bit, just in terms of the time frame of the movie. We're on day 54 of Matt Damon being stuck on Mars when they cut back to Earth, I think, for the first time, and they show his funeral. And I'm just kind of feeling like, wait, they waited 54 days to have a funeral for him?
Yeah, I mean—
that seems kind of weird.
How long would you— I mean, on Earth, you'd probably have a longer period of time till you, you know,
I wouldn't
report somebody missing.
At all. He's not missing. Like, they have abandoned him on Mars. They're convinced he's dead from the beginning. Like, there's never any— like, it's not like they're gonna— okay, well, it's—
yeah, you're right. They thought he died with the arrest.
They thought he died. Right. And these people launched and they left him behind after he got smacked in the face with a communications dish. And so he's dead. So why did they wait 54 days to have his funeral?
I don't know.
I wonder if that was, you know, originally earlier in the screenplay, and that's just where it felt like it cut in better. But that was, again, this is the level of nitpick I have with this movie in order to find anything wrong with it. Because other than that, I guess, and then my last thing is the zero G stuff I didn't find very convincing. It was very much felt like people on wires. And then they painted the wires out. They didn't move right, like when they sort of pushed themselves down hallways and stuff. It didn't really feel like they were propelling themselves down hallways. It felt like they were being moved down the hallway. There were a couple of places where it felt like they kind of turned in midair without actually touching anything, which is not really a thing that you can do in space.
Bugs Bunny can do that.
So the verisimilitude of the floating stuff didn't quite do it for me.
So the point is that probably the most scientifically impressive sci-fi movie ever made still has nitpicks.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that we haven't covered it yet, and we definitely will. The only movie that I think that it's impossible to find any scientific nitpicks with is Apollo 13. And, you know, they have the advantage there of being a true story and being faithful, almost completely faithful to that true story. And they also get the zero gravity right because they filmed it on a zero gravity airplane. So
there are so many good people in this movie. Jessica Chastain, we didn't even mention her. She's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Michael Pena. You mentioned Sean Bean, Sebastian Stan,
Kate Mara,
Kate Mackenzie Davis, Kate Mara, Donald Glover,
Benedict Wong,
Chiwetel.
It's great.
Benedict Wong. Yeah. So many good people in this movie. And they don't all get, obviously, but every one of them gets a moment or two.
And every one of them is perfect in the role that they're in. Like there's not a, you know, it's brilliantly written. And every single one of those actors, like, again, like it would be so easy for any one of those actors to overdo it. And none of them do. They all nail exactly the sort of level of this is a thing we need to be afraid of, but we're not going to freak out.
Right. And I think a movie like The Martian really, you know, kind of sums up one of our points about this show is that obviously you can make a brilliant sci-fi movie and 80% of your science can be nonsense. But if you're making a movie that is meant to take place within the realm of a real world, which this clearly is, it takes place in like 30 years or 20 years from now, but it's meant to be the real world.
Not even sure it's supposed to be that far.
Do whatever you can to, you know, being as close to reality makes your film all that much more impressive.
Well, even the tech stuff feels super, super real. Like when he's sitting in the rover and he's got like the little sort of laptops in front of him and it almost kind of looks like, you know, when like police officers have their little sort of mounted laptop on there. None of the graphics on those screens feel like they're some sort of like futuristic, like, oh, I'm, you know, which they do in so many sci-fi movies. There's no like hologram touch screens or any of that kind of stuff. Like those feel like, if you project the laptops that we have now, you know, 20 years in the future, that's what they will look
well,
like.
You know, as well as I do, that's what I think one thing that, you know, he's made some bad films and he's made some great films. But when it comes to sci-fi, Ridley Scott knows how to do like lived in technology. This guy did Alien. He did Blade Runner. He directed this and he seems to know like how he wants to make like a futuristic or technical world look real and lived in.
Yeah, but in this case, like, again, that's in some ways an even harder challenge because in Alien, like, you want it to feel tactile and real, but you have a whole lot of wiggle room in terms of, you know, because nobody knows what a spaceship in the 24th century or whatever it is going to look like. Here, like, you have a whole lot of I mean, in some ways it's easier because you have a whole lot of actual stuff that you can base it on. You look at what does actual NASA equipment look like now? And and again, it's that mix of stuff too, right? Because like you look at like the space shuttle and the space shuttle, you know, was built in the 80s, but it was obviously upgraded considerably over the course of its 20, 30 year lifespan. And so you end up with this sort of weird, like, mix of technologies, of things that are like, okay, this we perfected this technology in 1960 on Gemini, you know, with right next to, okay, this is latest state of the art 2030 or whatever it is, computers, you know, or some piece of technology that would never, you know, was only invented a week ago. And so that mix is, I think, one of the things that I find fascinating about the sort of quote unquote production design of any sort of NASA, real NASA stuff. Or for that matter, any scientific, like, if you walk into any science lab, you'll see this weird mix of things that were, like, developed in the 50s and things that look futuristic.
And I think that kind of touches on one of the biggest appeals of this movie is that if you're a sci-fi writer or director, you're allowed to cheat and write whatever you want. And, you know, you're allowed to make up the rules. But when you force yourself to stay within the rules of the real world, you make your job a lot harder. And I think that's why people were so impressed with this movie. It's because they did keep themselves within very tight limits. It would have been very easy to make The Martian with just half nonsense science. That would have been easy.
Yeah.
But,
well, that, you know, they were very faithful to the book, and the book was deliberately written to be a hard sci-fi look at, okay, what would an actual Mars mission look like if we projected our technology that we have now to sort of 10, 20 years in the future. And, you know, it was designed by somebody who knows their stuff to be exactly that. And the movie was smart enough to follow that lead and not Hollywooded.
I think you'd agree, Stephen. Most important, it's a fun movie. If it wasn't fun, none of this would matter. You'd say, yeah, it's impressive that they cared. And yeah, those that telemetry is accurate and that formula is correct. But your movie is dull, then I don't care. And that is the key. This movie is entertaining, intense, fun. It's great.
Can we talk about how great Matt Damon is in it? I mean, a big part of why, I mean, I think all of the actors make this movie as fun as it is, but obviously.
Well, Darius Wolski is the star of this movie, the cinematographer. Good Lord, is this a gorgeous movie to look at?
Yeah, and it gets the Mars landscapes right in the way that
Mission to Mars.
Mission to Mars.
Good Lord.
I can't even remember what the name of
the movie after you're done editing this episode, you never have to think of Mission to Mars ever again.
And I won't.
But yeah, I'm going to leave the rest of Martian up to you for your science stuff. But I think I was afraid that I'd be bored the second time. No, I enjoyed it more the second time. I think it's a fantastic movie. One of the best sci-fi movies of the last 10 years. And that's saying something because we've had some really good ones over the last since 2010. And it's fun. It's intense. It's scary. It works as like an adventure movie, like Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
So to speak.
And again, the fact that it wants to, from Andy Weir to Drew Goddard to Ridley Scott to everybody involved, to keeping it based in real science. I just admire the effort, let alone the follow through.
Yeah. So I will say this. I had the same sort of experience. I saw this in the theater with my wife when it came out. I really enjoyed it, but I don't remember. You know, like, I remember obviously appreciating the A+ science, and that is my grade for the science of this. It is as good as you can get on the science. But not being, you know, it didn't stick with me. It didn't stick to my ribs. And maybe it's because I watched Mission to Mars right before this. But I had so much more fun with it this time. Like, I really just, like, I was so engaged. I was so, like, again, from minute one, just, like, right there with Matt Damon and the chain of consequences of him trying to figure out how to solve all these problems and just – and then everybody else trying to figure out how to solve the problems for him. Joyous watching it this time around in a way that, you know, as much as I enjoyed it the first time, it didn't hit me that much. So I would give this a solid A, an A+, as I have been known to do. And I haven't really talked about the science nearly as much on this movie as I do in a lot of other ones, in part because, you know, there's very little to nitpick, but also, like, you know, one of the common questions people ask us in regards to the podcast about a movie is, you know, is such and such a thing scientifically accurate? Is X scientifically accurate or Y or whatever? And everything in this movie is, except for the like two or three things that I named, they're all scientifically accurate. So the answer to that question, if you're wondering, I wonder if this thing is scientifically accurate, pretty much for the most part, yeah, it is.
Entertainment value, it gets a solid A for me. I think it's Ridley Scott's best film since Blade Runner, and I'm not joking. I absolutely love it. And that's this long episode about Mars. We're going to go back to Mars. Stephen proposed that we do a Red Planet versus Ghosts of Mars, which I am totally down for because not everything has to be serious sci-fi. Some things can just be about monsters and carnage. But we both want to thank you so much for listening to Science versus Fiction. We're going to be publishing some of our old bonus episodes, some old Patreon episodes. We're going to be publishing those over the upcoming weeks. So hopefully you'll enjoy those. Those are some TV commentaries and just random nonsense from the two of us. So thank you for listening.
Thank you guys, and we will see you soon.